I'm proposing that in this new model, what you get is something much more powerful, much more efficient. You still have to learn the material. I'm not saying AI just do this thing for me. I want to learn how to do that. But what AI can do is create for me a custom tailored, ultra efficient way for me to learn that and be able to do it versus for you to learn it and to be able to do it.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of PeopleRain. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. Thanks, as always, for being part of this amazing global community. We learn from AI thought leaders weekly on this show, and of course, the added bonus, you get one AI fun fact each week. Today's fun fact, Sharon Goldman writes in VentureBeat that the New York Times versus OpenAI and Microsoft copyright fight will be the one to watch in 2024. The lawsuit calls for billions of dollars in compensatory damages and requires OpenAI and Microsoft to destroy any models that use New York Times copyrighted material. Goldman writes that legal experts have long predicted that a case around AI and copyright could make it to the Supreme Court, and this is likely to be the first one. Bradford Newman from law firm Baker McKenzie adds that legally, there's little guidance here. When you're using the massive data sets that these AI applications are, and you sprinkle on top of that open source licenses, the arguments are going to be fair use versus infringement. Google largely won its lawsuit versus the Authors Guild in 2015, which means the stakes for publishers are even higher now when facing LLMs that offer their content without attribution or compensation. Expect OpenAI and Microsoft to play strong defense. Goldman cites another copyright law attorney who says he's quite confident that the position of the technology companies on copyright is the one that should and hopefully will prevail. Whatever happens, expect this one to be expensive, high profile, and ultimately define how we'll use LLMs at work and at home. And of course, we will link to the full article in today's show notes. Now, shifting to this week's conversation, Dmitry Shapiro is a serial entrepreneur who most recently founded and is the CEO of UAI. He has a bold vision to help you index your mind, which we'll unpack in today's conversation. Previously, Dmitry founded and led GoMeta and created the video sharing site Veo in 2005, which launched just a few months after YouTube. Dmitry served as the CTO at MySpace before moving on to Google, where he was a group product manager working on social graph, identity, and content discovery. Dmitry received his BS in EE from Georgia Tech. And without further ado, Dmitry, it's my pleasure to welcome you to AI and the Future of Work. Let's get started by having you share a bit more about your background and how you got into this space.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to chat. So I'm not going to enumerate all of my professional adventures. I think you did a fine job highlighting some of them. There are many. If people want to know more about me, they can just Google me. These days, I describe myself as an old nerd. I started writing code in 1984 after I saw the movie War Games in the theater. And instead of having a normal high school, cool kids' high school life, I spent my time in the computer lab staring at a monochrome screen and studied electrical engineering, never done a day of it, always done software, and have been fortunate to be able to work on projects that I find interesting. If somebody else is doing them, I tend to join the company. If nobody is doing them, I tend to build companies like the three companies that I've built now. All have been venture-backed. I've now raised over $140 million in venture capital for them. And this is the latest one, Mind Studio, is the product that we have in market now.
Describe the vision behind Mind Studio.
So everyone's excited about this new era of computing when we have access to generative AI, and it's amazing. All we need to do is, you know, open up our browser or open up the, let's say, OpenAI app and start typing with our thumbs, because most of us are computing on mobile these days, commands to these, you know, language models or image diffusion models or whatever other models. And on one hand, that's amazing. We can just type words to it and it comes back with things that seem really intelligent and valuable. But at that same time, I think it's clear to us that is not the right interface for humans to be able to wield the power of AI. meaning computing didn't take off until we went from DOS to Windows. We nerds, you like command line interfaces, like typing in commands into a terminal. But the average end user cannot be expected to type long commands, again, especially with their thumbs, to learn how to discern between one model and another, to learn the concepts of prompt engineering and all of these things. So we believe that all models, whether they're language or image or video or code or whatever, should be relegated to being back-end services that are abstracted from end users by what we call the application layer. So the models live in the intelligence layer. Those are just commodity services. You get to choose, as the developer of the AI in the application layer, you get to choose whether you use OpenAI or Anthropic or Mistral or Google or Meta, open source, doesn't matter. You might use multiple models from various providers in the same AI application because some models are faster, some models are cheaper, some models are better quality at one thing versus another. In those three dimensions, you can optimize for. But then the end users simply get an application that does not require them to even understand whether an AI model is involved or not. And so MindStudio allows anyone to show up, watch some YouTube tutorials, and very quickly learn to build AI-powered applications. And these applications are just web apps. At the end of the day, they just have a URL. And so you can put them on your home screen on your phone. You can embed them anywhere. You can link to them. You can send them anywhere and do whatever you want. And they allow you to build countless things. Already, there are over 13,000 of these AIs that have been built and that are deployed across, I think, probably vast majority of industries, certainly, if not every industry, and in enterprises, SMBs, consumer, etc.
The library is vast in MindStudio, and the apps are very compelling. But I got to ask what OpenAI announced at Dev Day a couple months ago and what will soon be forthcoming. The LLM app store is quite similar, and the custom GPT interface for building LLM apps exclusively on OpenAI models, unlike MindStudio, which, as you mentioned, supports multiple LLMs. But otherwise, the experience seems similar, and the interface, what we expect from the GPT store, seems similar. Talk about differentiation of MindStudio apps and the developer or the creator experience versus the approach from OpenAI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so OpenAI's GPT and the GPT store, I think, is best seen as being like bookmarks for GPT prompts. Instead of you having to retype the same GPT prompt or maintain some PDF where you go and reference it and cut and paste, this GPT builder allows you to give this prompt a name, put in a prompt, potentially add some additional data that you upload to it, and voila, you've got this thing. And so in that case, it's similar to MindStudio that allows you to create this artifact that has a URL, that has a sort of a name, this package of a prompt. But MindStudio is radically more powerful. It allows you to create, for example, multi-step workflows that allow you to get input from a user, different types of input. So it allows you, in a sense, to create like form elements and get the user to give you text or upload files or, you know, choose slider controls, various things like we expect from applications, different types of controls for the user to be able to give it input. It then allows you to create logic and these multi-step workflows that choose different paths based upon what this app is meant to do, to call different models within that workflow, at different parts of the workflow with different parameters, to tune a bunch of parameters of these models. If you compare it out, compare it to Microsoft Paint to Photoshop. They're both apps that let you edit an image, but one is a professional tool that you can build amazing things with, and one is a cute little thing that makes it just a little bit better. And so we believe that no matter what people, you know, more sophisticated users, enterprise, business users, people that are serious, want these capabilities beyond what GPTs offer them. And certainly not locked in to one provider, which is GPT. For example, we've got now thousands of websites that embed Mind Studio AIs in the website. When you, consumers, show up to the website, it doesn't ask you to log into GPT in order to be able to use that. It just allows you to use it. But that's not the way that GPTs work. GPTs make GPT better for GPT users. So it's just a very different kind of a thing. Only similar in the fact that they both package up some prompt in this case, but we add so much more to it.
Regardless, Mind Studio is way ahead. Who knows where OpenAI will go, but congrats on building an amazing library. Now, you and I are both old nerds, and we're talking to an audience that consists of many old nerds. So I think you made an important decision when you decided to support multiple LLMs. I saw that you support a combination of Claude from Anthropic, PaLM models from Google, Llama from Meta, as well as the ChatGPT models. Talk about the pros and cons of the different LLMs and what led you to make that decision.
Yeah, great question. There are a bunch of things that, you know, people who spend a lot more time evaluating models and comparing them to one another have published. And so I think my opinion on which model is better for what things are going to be incomplete and shallow, and that's actually not where I spend my time. But there are differences between models. And again, mostly they are a function of three things. How good is the model quality or the specific use case? Some models are better at taking, you know, long documents and extracting salient important points. Some models are good at taking a bunch of bullet points, for example, that were extracted by one model and then passed to another model, which is much better than that model at taking those points and generating new things. So the quality, depending on what the use case is. So that's one dimension. Another dimension is performance. How fast are they at doing that? Because that matters, especially if you create longer workflows. And the third one is cost. Like, how expensive are they? And then there's a bunch of other things like privacy and other things. Like, so some people like to call, you know, models where they're running inference on premises. And so they need those models, et cetera. Okay. Model agnosticism goes above that, one layer above that, which is, again, we believe that just like everything else in computing, when there's competition, and there is a lot of competition in creating models, and especially now with this very healthy open source, you know, movement that we have in models, that there will be lots of different choices for app creators, app developers, to choose the right combination of models for each application. And that's critical, that you shouldn't only be allowed to use models from one model provider. That does not make sense, to at least to me, in the modern world. You need the flexibility, you know, you need the ability to be able to use the best of breed things. And that's why we're model agnostic.
Pause your crystal ball. If we roll back the clock to November 2022, when OpenAI launched ChatGPT, it seemed like their lead was insurmountable. $10 billion investment from Microsoft. And then, of course, in the ensuing year, every other company that we call big tech had its own model, as well as just a mushroom cloud explosion of very specific open source LLMs. What's your perspective on open source versus closed? And what is there a coming shakeout in the model ecosystem? What should we expect over the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's, again, we're all, you and I are old enough to have seen many cycles of new technologies showing up in their adoption and where bets get placed and, you know, incumbents versus disruptors, etc. It really did seem last fall that there might be this weird situation where one company runs away with all of it. And in fact, there are many articles that people could find, you know, if they Google, that claim, you know, very serious venture capitalists and other sort of like theoretically really smart and experienced people making the claims that OpenAI is going to own not only just the model business, but everything else, like manufacture automobiles, because their model is going to be so brilliant, it's going to figure out how to build better factories than Tesla and automate all of that. And so it'll be one company to rule them all. There'll be just one company doing everything, running everything. And this like AGI is going to solve all of it. In fact, Sam, I always love to listen to Sam weave his web of magic, talking about, for example, that, you know, OpenAI went into this not having a business model, and the business model is to build AGI, which then will figure out the business model. And so all of this is wonderful, but now a year later, it's also clear that, boy, were those people wrong. And boy, are the people that sank all that money into OpenAI at these like crazy valuation rounds, or Anthropic, or any of these other things. I think you're going to have a bloodbath there of destruction of value. Open source is going to play in this case an extraordinarily powerful role. It's already clear. Large language models are important for certain things, are difficult, expensive to train and retrain in that. And again, there's a need for them, and I'm glad that there are companies that are doing that. Again, these companies are cloud services. They're metered cloud services. They're like Azure or AWS or Google Cloud. In fact, they are exactly that. Microsoft is OpenAI, Anthropic is Google and Amazon, right? Like, these are the people that are like backing them. And that's what these things are. They go to commodity. As long as you got the money to pay metered, you can access them. But I think the real optimization is going to happen in small models made just for purpose that do little bitty things and then do them much faster, much cheaper. And the ability to take those and put them together is like Lego blocks. Again, this is where we play. We believe is the real opportunity to take that. And I certainly don't believe this idea that in an enterprise, you just give everybody a ChatGPT account and now you are enabled with AI. I think that makes no sense whatsoever moving forward.
So you and the team have shipped this store with LLM apps, but I know your vision goes way beyond that app store. I've heard you talk about indexing the mind. Talk to us about the broader vision. What does that mean when you say that?
Yeah, so I want to make sure I don't confuse our listeners here. So you indeed would, if you went and searched around on YouTube or Google, find me speaking about this concept of indexing the mind, which I will talk about here. But at Mind Studio, we are not building anything having to do with that. That evolves later, again, whether we build it or other people build it. And so I'm going to point to you what I think is obvious as the future of computing, at least to me, and I'm willing to defend it. But I don't want people to get confused at Mind Studios for that. It is not. Okay, mind indexing. Imagine you found a lamp and you rubbed the lamp and a genie came out. And the genie says, I know everything and I'm your servant. And whatever question you've got, you can ask me any question you want. You know, some people might scratch their head and say, I don't know what question to ask. Other people say, of course I know. It's an existential question. Why are we here and what should I be doing? I believe the right question to ask is different. And that question is, what question should I ask? Because I think one of our biggest problems as human beings is we don't know what we don't know. We tend not to know our own strengths and certainly not know our weaknesses very well, not know where our gaps of knowledge lie. We might say that we know a certain area, computing or programming or whatever, and that we are an expert, not realizing that there are some core fundamental concepts that we still have wrong. We function, we pretend to be experts, but we are not experts. And so what if we could change the relationship around? And instead of us prompting the AIs to do things for us that we can think of, what if we changed that around and said, you, AI, be in the driver's seat. Assess me. Figure out my strengths and weaknesses that I myself might not know. And then help fill in my weaknesses, help fill in my gaps of knowledge, create custom learning materials for me to bridge my gaps of knowledge, and help me live a better life, more productive, happier, healthier, etc. The way to do that, we believe, is to, again, provide some interface between human and machine in order for the machine to get all that data about me. Now, how do you do that? One way is conversational, where I decide to get into this chat conversation with an AI that's playing the role, in the sense of Larry King, of interviewing me, right? Another way of doing it is potentially to give me a long feed, think like TikTok, a long feed of interfaces that allow me, the human, to go through it, in the sense sort of answer questions. And those interfaces could be open answer, or they could be multiple choice, or they could be a big grid of images that says tap all that seem yummy. Once you get done with this grid, it gives you another grid of images. It says now tap all that seem yummy. And it, again, is smart, just like TikTok is really good at very quickly figuring out what video to show you next that you're going to watch and engage with. This thing could get really good at figuring out how to very quickly detect all of those nuances about you to differentiate you from me. And then start to give you proactively to make your life better, to find things you would never have searched for because you don't even know they exist, but say, oh, you could use one of these. You know, imagine if you lived in a world where you were missing a leg, but you didn't know that there were leg prosthetics. This thing would recognize that, hey, you need a leg. There are these things called prosthetics. They're magical. Let me get you one of those. And so the same thing, that's what we talk about mind indexing, is how do you create interfaces for humans to be able to get a lot of things out of their mind into a digital form that AI can then take, parse, find patterns, detect anomalies, and then make your life better.
Dmitri, I'm going to challenge you, but not on the science, because like you, I believe that it's imminent that the capabilities of the technology will support what you just described. I'm going to instead challenge you on the philosophy behind it. I believe that it's so fundamental to the human experience that we synthesize our how we experience with the world, our spatial relationships, our human relationships, and that's what it means be a human. When you have something synthetic, something silicon-based that is, like you said, indexing your mind and providing maybe a set of recommendations like TikTok provides, you know, the next recommended video, what does it mean to be a human when we've outsourced that critical synthesis process to silicon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another way of putting it is how important is serendipity to life, right? Yeah. So I think the outsourced might be, in my opinion, the wrong word here. That's not what I'm proposing. I'm not proposing that people get on some kind of autopilot and not use their minds. Imagine if you are trying to learn something, whatever it is. In today's world, you try to go find the content about that thing. You might watch a bunch of YouTube tutorials or read documentation or whatever it is. And those things are all written for the general public. They're written for scale, for the lowest common denominator, because production of content requires that to be the case. You can't produce content for tiny niches. It doesn't work economically. And therefore, the content is made for no one because it's made for everyone. And so you have to watch a bunch of different videos to find a little nugget from this video and another nugget from this video, or do a bunch of research. I'm proposing that in this new model, what you get is something much more powerful, much more efficient. You still have to learn the material. I'm not saying AI just do this thing for me. I want to learn how to do that. But what AI can do is create for me a custom-tailored, ultra-efficient way for me to learn that and be able to do it versus for you to learn it and to be able to do it. And that simply is a function of efficiency. And that's why we get into the serendipity, where people say, hey, look, you know, a lot of people talk about this in dating, but like dating sites, because you can dial in your mate, kill romance, because you didn't just randomly meet him on the street and you had that moment of serendipity. And I grok what they're saying. The element of surprise is what humans live for, you know, I would argue. But efficiency is the other side of that coin. And I would argue that by creating extreme efficiency, you actually get much more serendipity. Now, could you get too much of a good thing, too much serendipity? Could you get tired of winning? You could. And, you know, if you accelerate your pace of learning radically, you will find other issues. Your brain is now polluted. You've learned too many things. You got no more time for anything else. Like, the bottleneck is always the human brain, I believe. You know, our ability to consume information and make sense of it and then use it and recall it and all of that.
We can't have this discussion without thinking about the ethical implications of brain that's potentially synthetically controlled, or where your thoughts are influenced by external content. I know this is a conversation of, you know, vision of the future, but the pragmatist in me says, who gets to control what shows up in my brain feed? When we think about, you know, kids using TikTok and, you know, do they watch the next cat video, or is it, you know, the Barbenheimer, easy for me to say, video, you know, somewhat innocuous. But when it's controlling important life decisions, I get, you know, a little bit more sensitive about, you know, what it means to have potentially big tech or anyone really sponsor the brain feed. What are your thoughts about how we create a construct that could ethically regulate this, the pros that you've, you know, I think correctly described, with, of course, the potential ramifications that may be unanticipated?
So we already live in a world where infinite amount of content is available to us, and what we believe and what we learn is a function of what we stumble across, or what our social graphs stumble across and bubble up, or who we trust in our social graphs that speak about certain things that they also consume. So this is, I think, one of the reasons we are struggling so much as a society with misinformation, disinformation, the fragmenting of our social fabric, where we are now polarized, all of that. These are all symptoms of content that we consume, right? And so this is a real problem. And by the way, I would argue this is the biggest problem the world faces, bigger than global warming or anything else, because the only way we can solve these other problems like global warming is if we work in alignment with our at least fellow countrymen, and also as the world. But we can't do that if we are being, you know, fragmented by algorithms, in a sense, doing it. Okay, so this is a real problem. Now, does this new approach that I'm pointing at, does that help the problem or exacerbate it? I believe it helps it. Meaning, I believe that who should be in control? Each individual human should be in control of what it is that, in a sense, their AI feed that's being generated for them is giving them. And we should give them, by the way, tools to be able to evaluate that, to be able to understand it. What is this nudging me towards? And I, human, should be able to say, I would like to feel like this, or I'd like to be more aligned like this. I want to be a good member of society that believes that we together are all Americans and should be unified. And so I want that point of view. You might have somebody else says, no, I'm a radical revolutionary. I want to fragment the country and destroy the deep state. It, by the way, you should be able to have that feed, because you can have that feed already. And so the tech generally should be unopinionated about that and provide for you what you want. Now, you should be able to tune it, I think, in a different way, though, to say, what are the derivative results that you want out of your feed? And derivative results I want is I want health and happiness and, you know, and peace and things like that, but then it should be able to give me that. And yes, by the way, biases exist everywhere. I think, you know, all we can do as technologists is work on biases being clear and generally in err on the side of good versus evil, like Google's motto, don't be evil. There's a reason.
Speaking of Google, like that. You certainly know as well as anyone, having spent time there, that the adage that we use in Silicon Valley, if you're not paying, you're the product. And, you know, when we extrapolate out to potentially, you know, implants or like however it gets implemented, but things that potentially could provide this kind of mind feed or brain feed, we have to think through the commercial implications, that it's inevitable that someone will want to provide that feed for free and potentially have access to the feed, put your thoughts in the cloud and be able to do a lot of things. You know, that's certainly a security breach that would make me concerned if my thoughts in the cloud were breached, or, you know, for that matter, it would be infinitely easier to manipulate thoughts with that, you know, with that kind of interface.
Yes.
What's the regulatory framework that you'd propose, or how do we think about that very real potential that capitalist pursuits would?
This is a great question that has many dimensions, obviously. So I'll give you the the short answer of it. I've always liked that saying, you know, that if you're not paying, you're the product. But I think that it's used to imply that there's something sinister and bad about that versus that might be perfectly fine because the dynamics of, you know, business in this case, you find a win-win situation. So I think I'm less concerned about whether you're paying for it or not. By the way, I'm certain there'll be things that lean more into privacy that you pay for, and there are things that lean more into either convenience or I don't want to pay, and you're fine living with that. And there's like a bunch of sort of dynamics there. The fact that an extraordinarily fine-tuned, personalized, compelling feed of learning, let's just call it learning, whether it's entertainment or learning or whatever, content consumption, where you could argue that's a brain, ultimate brainwashing tool. To that, I say that dirty minds could use some washing. And I would argue and propose that today, if we are honest with ourselves and we meditate in a sense and take a look at our own internal states, we mostly are going to find a lot of chaos and a lot of things that we humans do that aren't good for us. And we wish we used social media less, but we can't because it's extremely addictive because we like seeing other people's whatever or this and that, no, showing off, etc. And these are really powerful tools. And again, I think as long as the people who are building them have the right intentions, which by the way, I spent 4.25 years at Google. I was at a senior enough level where I got to see, be exposed to a lot of senior people. And I can report to you and your listeners here where everybody talks smack about Google, of Google has all this information and Google is spying on you and Google is evil and all that. I saw nothing of the sort whatsoever. In fact, I saw the extreme, the ultimate extreme of the opposite, of extraordinary sensitivity to privacy and ethics and doing the right thing, foregoing, you know, things that would be easier to do to get more profit, and true champions on every team in every meeting, multiple champions championing the, you know, the other thing. And so I feel generally comfortable as a human and a father of 5 children, by the way. So I think about this a lot, that I trust at least Google and also Meta and also, you know, NVIDIA and like these core companies that are part of this, I believe should be supported, trusted, and verified, you know, monitored, verified. We shouldn't just put it on autopilot, but that we can walk bravely into this new world and leverage these new technologies.
An interesting point there about brainwashing. And given, you know, I've got 2 kids, teenagers, you got 5 kids. When we think about, you know, potentially the metification or the Googleification of our kids' minds, who gets to say what, quote, a dirty mind looks like? Who owns that, the definition, and is deputized to wash the dirty mind?
Until the child, I believe, is of some threshold that the parent should decide is, you know, mature, let's call it, enough to be able to grok that if they plug into social media or the internet, that there'll be opposing viewpoints and they should generally understand dynamics of which ones are real, which ones are not, how to discern. Until that, I think the parents are responsible for that. Beyond that, when the child is mature, and each individual is responsible for that. It is up to us. We can very easily go and find ourselves in a group of people that are, have a point of view, cults, for example. So lots of people join cults and are sucked into that voluntarily and will argue that they are the healthy ones and somebody else isn't. Great, I believe that should be their right if they're mature to be able to do that. At the same time, if you want to optimize for not joining a cult, if that's one of your things, that's one of my things, your AI can help you. It can help you watch out for those kinds of dynamics where you might not even realize it, but the AI can say, hey, this feels a little bit cultish maybe. It's got similar patterns. You might say, no, it's not, but maybe it is. So anyway, so I think each individual is responsible for it. It's not big tech, certainly not regulators, in my opinion. I think there's no real way to have governments, in a sense, regulating this. They will try, certainly. But I can't come up with any ideas on how that might actually be manifested.
You and I and people like Jan LeCun are AI optimists, and we believe that if humans are smart enough to create this technology, we'll also be smart enough to rein it in, and ultimately the good actors will prevail. But these are important topics to discuss.
I think the dangers in the near term are great dangers. And that is that these technologies in the hands of bad actors, especially, you know, bad state actors, people who have real resources to be able to scale a chaos, are extraordinarily dangerous. That can, again, break democracies and launch wars and create all kinds of nastiness. But if we can get through that phase, I think that's a big if. But if we could get through that phase, I think we've got incredible positive things ahead of us.
Said, I hate to end this conversation. This is really fascinating, and I hope you'll come back and maybe we'll continue it another time. But I got to get us to a stopping point, but I'm not letting you off the hot seat without answering one last question for me. So let's say we are having a version of this conversation, and instead of 2024, it's 2034. What are we talking about in terms of our relationship as humans, maybe not just with LLMs, but with the power of automated decisions more broadly? How has it impacted what it means to be a human in the next decade?
Yeah. So along with that, if we continue to extrapolate on that mind indexing thing that we were talking about, again, I believe one of the areas that's going to be the most impactful because of these new advancements in AI and mind indexing is our ability to interact with one another, how we approach each other as we first meet. In today's world, if we meet some stranger, let's say, on the street, we have to have a conversation with them, and we slowly get to know one another, and we slowly start to realize that we have some things in common, we have some differences, that this stranger also knows some other people or something about our hobby that's really, you know, weird, etc., right? And that all takes time and a lot of conversation. And most of the time, we don't have time to talk to strangers about that because we're going about our busy lives. Once our minds are indexed, meaning once we've engaged with the machine, when we meet one another, we can instantly skip all of that and know one another in a moment better than we know our closest friends and family over our entire lifetime of being with them. And then to be able to, again, instantly go into the depths of what's important, what's interesting, and go together. So this ability to instantly have much deeper and much broader conversations as one-on-one or inside of teams where, you know, build, like now I've built three companies, I've worked on big teams. Team alignment is extraordinarily difficult and ultimately lossy and poor. It's in the dark ages. To get a team aligned and keep them aligned, they might say they're aligned. And on superficial dimensions, they might be aligned. But when you look at how they're operating, they're misaligned. They're not rowing in the same direction. They're generally rowing north, but one is going northeast and one is going northwest. When you talk to them, they both think they're going north, but the direction isn't north. The direction is this many degrees northwest. How do you get that and stay aligned? Again, all of these types of mind indexing things can help. And so I just think that fundamentally changes how we work with one another, human relationships. You will be able to find soulmates, everyone, true deep soulmates, people you were meant to be with. That's crazy. What are the implications of that? You will meet the people that are missing in your life that can help you be a better person as a partner in business. What are the implications of that? Recruiting is horribly broken. It is shockingly bad and difficult in today's world. Once minds are indexed, recruiting becomes a cinch because you were meant to work together. Fantastic. Let's talk about that. All of that, I'm really excited in the next, again, if we can get past this phase, we can do incredible things with that. And again, once we have that, then we are aligned. And then we as a society can say, let's solve global warming. Let's solve inequality. Let's solve all of these things that trouble us. Let's solve energy. And then we're off to the races.
Fascinating. That's a good vision for a future that I'd like my kids to inherit. Very well articulated, and I hope we get a chance to pick up where we're leaving off in a subsequent conversation.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Great. Thanks.
Dmitri, before I let you go, where can the audience learn more about you and the good work you're doing?
I'm very active on LinkedIn. So if you just look for Dmitri Shapiro, you should be able to find me. I should be the first one coming up. You can also just Google me. I'm active on all social services other than TikTok or Instagram, actually. But you'll be able to find me if you want, then feel free and add me on LinkedIn. I tend to accept connections.
Great work and wishing you all the best.
Thanks so much.
And that's all the time we have for this week on AI and the future of work. As always, I'm your host, Dan Turchin from PeopleRain. And of course, we're back next week with another fascinating guest.